This is an interview with Mr. James Franco, who has lived for most of his life in San Diego and was 15 years old at the onset of the Great Depression. This interview is being conducted on November 3rd, 1973 at the interviewer's home in La Mesa, California. The interviewer is Jim Dacus. All right, Mr. Franco, could you first tell us a little bit about your background? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I came to this country at the age of 7 with my mother. My father had preceded us for a few years. He came looking for his fortune, as the saying goes, and when he was situated comfortably and thought the time was right, he sent for us, and my mother and I arrived in San Diego in June, I believe it was, June or July of 1921. And of course, I just can't quite put it into words how impressed I was even at that age at this almost miraculous new environment that I found myself in. Truly, the land of plenty, as Europeans were often told, and that's what we found when we came here. Well, it was just, as I said before, unbelievable. Ice cream, for instance. First time I ever had ice cream when I was 7 years old in San Diego. I'll never forget it.
So, when the Depression hit here in San Diego, you were what? You mentioned
well,
15
about
years old?
15 and a half, something
15
like
and a half. I was wondering, how did it first touch your life? How did it first affect you when times first started getting bad?
Well, it was really...
you probably remember some specific...
Well, as I said, I was 15 and a half years old. It was a shock when I finally realized, when I finally could read the expression of agony in my parents' eyes, and really realized that a way of life had suddenly ended. It's hard for me to put into words. It was just a feeling of disbelief, and in fact, I was scared. I found myself worrying, wondering what was going to happen next. You see, I'd been through deprivation and through hunger and all sorts of suffering. Without even the basic needs that a person requires. And here, to my amazement, I was trying to absorb in my mind again that it was going to be a repetition of this.
You mentioned that a way of life was about to end. What was that way of life you're talking about?
Well, for
was your family fairly well off?
Yes, comfortably off. They were wealthy. My father knew his trade, and we were, I would say, a middle income group.
What did he do?
Well, he was from an early age in the old country, in Greece. He was a fisherman, and that's the profession he took up here and did very well with it. And he made, as I said before, a very good living. We lacked nothing. We had, of course, everybody has their own taste, you know, but our taste, the things that we required, that we needed out of life, were more than ample. That's the only way I can put it.
And so what you're saying is then that he lost his job?
That's right. He lost more than just his job. He lost his business.
He had his own business.
By that time, he had finally acquired 100% ownership in a wholesale fish market.
I see.
And we're doing very well when the crash of 1929 hit us.
And how did the crash cause him to lose his business?
Well, the usual thing, accounts payable that were no longer collectible.
That's right, you can just do that.
Right, thousands of dollars, people, retail markets, restaurants that he had supplied through had, were closing one after another, going bankrupt, even not even taking the trouble to go bankrupt. There just wasn't any money to pay their bills. And of course, that just bounced back onto him. He couldn't pay his own bills, so that was it. He had just to give it up. It was within, I would say, less than 6 months after the stock market crash, he himself was looking for a job. And the only field that he knew, starting all over again, or trying to, as an employee rather than as an owner.
I see. So how did this folding of the business, the family business, affect your family?
Well, it was. I suppose it affected everyone generally. I know it did in America, but some to a more extent than others. I can speak only for myself, my family. It was just, as I said before, a shock that everything that they had worked for, my dad had built up, was suddenly wiped out. And I remember, up to that time I had heard the paper boys screaming about the stock market crash and all that sort of thing, but it just went in one ear and out the other. I could care less about what was happening on Wall Street, or knew less than that. But I remember one day approaching my dad and asking him for 75 cents that I needed. I hadn't realized yet what had happened. And to my amazement, he looked at me. He had a strange look in his eyes I'd never seen before. A kind of an agonizing look, you know. And said something about, well, there's no more money, Jimmy. No more money now. All we have now is to worry about how we're going to eat now. We turned away, and I left. I had gone down to his market. I wanted 75 cents. I needed a notebook. I remember now. Yeah. A notebook for my Spanish class. And up till then, providing I was a good boy and did my chores, anytime I asked him for a dollar or you name it, a half a dollar or 75 cents, there was no problem until this particular day. I remember walking home. I hated to even ask him for the car fare. And I was trying to absorb, I was trying to realize what really had happened. I knew something terrible had happened, but I was just numb. And of course, subsequent events, brought the reality to me, the country, in fact, even portions of the world were affected by this Great Depression, which caused untold suffering over a period of several years.
I see. Well, it must have been a horrible experience there. How did this affect your family? Seems to be a horrible psychological experience.
I'm glad you brought that up.
How did that? What effect did that have on the family?
I'm glad you mentioned the psychological effect. Now this, I can think back now. Of course, I didn't realize at the time, but that was the worst effect, I think, in not just in our family. Just especially in our case, where we had left a country where deprivation and hunger, and as I mentioned before, were common, and had come here to as I said before, the land of plenty, and then suddenly to realize that this cycle had
started again.
Started again, It was hard to understand. It was hard to believe. It was more frightening, in fact, than the original, because we were born into that, you see. But then now we had no place to go, you see. We had the hope then of America. And now we didn't have that, you see. We were on our own. And there was nowhere to go. There was no hope. At least not that we knew at the time.
Yeah, I see.
And that's why it hit us and others in our situation that migrated here a little harder, I believe, than the ordinary person.
I see.
So, well, anyway, it was rough. My dad and I had a talk. He wanted me to finish school. He pointed out to me that was the most important thing, and I was glad to. There was no jobs anyway. I had walked the streets for part-time jobs all day long, looking for something to do for on a Saturday and Sunday. Well, it was just useless. It was just futile. But he said somehow, somewhere, some way, I would have to get through school. And the following 3 years, I'm talking about 1930. 31, 32, in fact, until I graduated, I think it was February of 33. And as I grew older, and those first years were to a young fella, you know, there was always those few that had some things. You know what I mean? There was always the exceptions. There were some kids in school who, apparently, by the way they dressed and the way they spend money at the cafeteria, the depression hadn't touched them quite as impressive on them as it was to me. But I remember through high school that my biggest problem or change. That's the only word I can use to describe my feelings was at the condition of my clothes while I was attending class. They were clean, but patched and repatched,
right.
You know what I'm talking about. And I remember the psychological effect that had on me, trying to hide from my friends as much as possible as you can. Naturally, after school, for example, those that were better off than me, I would have to almost run away so that I wouldn't be asked or invited into any little gatherings they might have, because I felt that I was, and was, in fact, worse off financially than they were. It was obvious, even though they weren't exactly in the lap of luxury or anything like that. But still, that is, I would say that was the biggest psychological effect on me personally, was those early high school years when they were supposed to be the happiest years, and should have been. And unfortunately to me, they were days that I try not to remember as much as possible.
Hard time.
Well, as I said before, the way they,
yeah.
Maybe it's just the way they affected me. I can't speak for anyone else.
Did you notice it just from physical appearances? Were there a sizable number of kids that looked? You mentioned your clothes.
Well, not a sizable number. I would say in that high school, approximately 4,000 to 5,000.
This is what, San Diego?
San Diego High. Anyway, I would say there was about a dozen, if not less. Fellas my age that seemed to, for some reason,
worse off than the others.
No, they were well off.
Oh,
but
say
I think
it. Oh.
I think the vast majority, of course, were in the same situation. But I don't know if this is the psychological effect, the part of the psychological effect had on me. But I thought that I was the worst.
Yeah,
I can't explain it. I was poorest of all.
Yeah,
you see what I mean.
Yeah,
and probably they themselves thought the same. In retrospect, I would say that they probably felt as I did. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, it was rough.
How did you mention your father lost his business? How did the family get by during those first years?
Well, mostly some help from relatives that were not hit quite as hard. Out of town relatives, out of state relatives.
How did they help?
Well, in one respect, they kept that roof. My uncle, my mother's brother, kept that little roof we had over our heads. I came home from school one day and read a tag that had been posted in the front yard earlier that day. My mother could not read it and was waiting for me to explain it to her, and it stated that this house was to be sold at auction on some such a date, about 3 or 4 weeks in the future.
I see.
We were actually going to be
that's one thing that sticks
street.
In your mind. You're going to be evicted.
I'll never forget that, or the agony that my mother went through more and more.
See. Okay, you were talking, Mr. Franco, about getting help from your relatives during these times. You said earlier that jobs were hard to get. I was wondering what other experiences did you have during these times of trying to get by? We were talking about that.
Well, we struggled through, Jim. We raised chickens, we raised rabbits, we grew our own vegetables. And occasionally we would sell a few dozen eggs. And that's right. When we couldn't sell them, we actually traded them. We'd trade them at the grocery store for other staples that we couldn't buy. And, as I said before, it was a struggle, but we pulled through.
Right. About income, though, money to live on. What you mentioned that your father lost the job, there was no money coming in there.
Right.
What did the family do?
Well,
you had to have the
before,
money to buy some food.
Right. Well, now, we would, as I mentioned, sell the eggs and rabbits to those that could afford it, and there were small crises. For example, a utility bill couldn't be paid, and we'd be threatened with a water shutoff. In fact, that happened on several occasions.
Every water shutoff?
Yeah. I remember my mother frantically filling the bathtub with water and any other container that she could find in the house. And then somehow, a few dollars would come in and the bill would be paid and that crisis would pass. And actually, this is funny, there was actually a little interlude of happiness, believe it or not. I remember the day that the gas was shut off, and my mother had to cook in the backyard over an open fire. It's like a camping trip, you know?
Yeah.
I remember we enjoyed that. It was fun. And, well, as far as my worst fear that I had originally, they never did really materialize. We never went hungry. And there was always the old wood stoves to keep us warm on cold nights. We were determined we were going to get through this, and we did. For example, when I was finally graduated from San Diego High School, that was in 1933, in February. I didn't even bother to go after my diploma. I had heard that there was college graduates with degrees looking for the same type of work I was desperately hunting for, washing dishes.
Well, yeah, what Okay, you mentioned how you were hunting for work. What kind of work did you
just
get?
Just anything at all. Now, mainly in restaurants. On a weekend.
Could you talk a little bit about that now? About some of those experiences?
Well,
working experiences during the Depression?
One that I remember very vividly. You just recall it to my mind. On the day I graduated, I just walked down that broad sidewalk directly to town and parked, as I usually did, crawling from one restaurant to the other. And to my amazement, I ran into walked into a place one day, and yes, they needed a dishwasher. $10 a week, 12 hours a day. If he'd have said 14 hours a day, I'd have said gladly. And I remember how I ran most of the way home. I was so eager to tell my parents the happy news. And I started working, and why, it was just heaven. Anyway, about a month passed, and one day I want to bring this up just for the impact, to really make you understand,
yeah,
to what extent people went in those days for work, for something, for sustenance. In this case, the owner of that restaurant came up to me and said, "Jim, I don't know how to tell you this, but I have to hire a man who has five small children, and he doesn't even expect any money. All he wants is just enough food to take home to his family every night." Now this is the extent that some people went to.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I found myself out of a job, and it was really something you couldn't fight, you know, the way he put it, about this the needs, the apparent greater needs of this particular individual than mine were. And one other thing, I don't want to dwell on this by way of criticism, but another bad situation that existed during that time was the retired Navy personnel. Now, you see, they were retiring after 20 years with I'd say, about $150 a month pension, which was a lot of money, at that time. And in order to supplement that income, these individuals would go to an employer, any employer. They would just walk in and say, "How much are you paying that man?" And then they would offer to work for half that amount. And the employer, I don't want to, criticize him. Maybe it wasn't greed on his part. It could have been the opposite. It could have been need on his part. He had no alternative, it seems to me, but to accept to hire a retired man with income, and there was another civilian, again, out of work. And this was another one of those problems that not I at my age particularly, but the adults that were fortunate enough to be working had to contend with at that time.
They'd lose their jobs, didn't they?
That's right. I'd heard of many of these incidents, and I was...
Especially in San Diego.
Right, especially in San Diego, a Navy town, as you well know. And I wanted to bring this out as one of the unexplainable, really, as far as my intelligence is concerned, tragedies that seem to just make the Depression just that much worse for those that...
I'd like to talk about that. Must have caused a lot of bitterness by a lot of people.
I'm sure it did. But
was that very widespread, what you just got to tell me about the meeting?
I think it was. I think I would call it widespread, yes. Yes, indeed. I think hardly a month would pass that I didn't hear one or two cases of someone losing a job under the circumstances that I just...
To his Navy?
Related to
retired.
You. Yes. It was one of those added evils, I'm sorry to use the word, that existed.
Yeah.
And,
well, getting back to you, what did you go from just one job after
the... Right. Yes, in most instances, it would be work for a week. Someone would be ill, for example, vacations. They were out of the question, of course,
right.
Except for civil service personnel. Those that took vacations seemed to live in another world, as far as I was concerned. I just wanted to work, as millions in my situation wanted to do. But finally, as I mentioned before, in 1933, when I finally graduated, if I'd known, Jimmy, that you were going to question me on this, I would have had some dates and had my information
okay.
a little more chronologically okay. in order. But I'm trying to bring the change in the political situation back into focus here. I think it's of tremendous importance. And even at an early age, I was aware of what was going on. Now, we were under the leadership of President Hoover at the time. I'm sure you remember in your history.
Right.
And President Hoover was a highly conservative man who kept insisting on his periodic talks to the people that
prosperity is
right around the corner.
Right. Yeah.
And that we would pull out of this without government intervention. We had the guts and this and that, you know. But it seemed like as the months and the years passed, that corner got further and further away. You know,
you were looking at it from the working man's point of view. What was the sentiment from people that you were associating with, the working people, towards Hoover and his refusal to open?
Sentiment was really widespread. From what I could gather, even as preoccupied as I was to just to provide for my bare existence and my family, I did pay some attention and do remember the resentment that, you have heard of the march of the veterans on the Capitol
right.
at that time who were cheated more or less out of their pay. This sort of thing went on, and the way they were treated up there, it was just an unbearable situation. And I believe that this administration change the entire political thinking. In fact, I think they certainly changed my philosophy of government, and it's stuck with me ever since. And I believe that is where the strength, the present strength of the Democratic Party lies. Here was a man that was promising us relief, immediate relief. It was unbelievable. But he certainly deserved the people's vote, and he got it.
Right.
And he kept his word. And this is another thing I'll never forget. Within 30 days, then, he created and had an operation, the Civilian Conservation Corps, that you probably heard about, the CCC camp.
Right.
And I found myself with a job as long as I wanted it. $30 a month. A lot of money at that time. 25 went to the family, and a whole $5 bill went to me.
that was
really,
big money.
Oh, that was heaven. And at the same time, almost simultaneously, he created the WPA. You've heard of that, the Work Public Administration, which provided work for millions of adults in all types of constructive improvements to the country. And it was, he called it the New Deal, and it was. It was a New Deal, finally.
Okay.
For the people.
So up until this the New Deal legislation went through, both you and your father were more or less the breadwinners for the family.
Right.
The Franco family were just sort of gliding from job to job, trying
right.
to pick up whatever you could.
Whatever was available.
No form of welfare relief.
Oh, my God, Jim. Welfare was unheard of. Any public assistance, for example, what we have today, unemployment insurance and disability insurance and the Social Security, as you know, of course, Roosevelt initiated that. We had nothing to fall back on. We were entirely on our own.
Right.
And
so he comes into the
there's a picture, and he starts this, and this is your first steady job for you and your father.
Right.
Since the...
Right.
Okay,
right.
What?
We could finally hold our heads up.
Right.
And we felt that the worst was finally over, and this is something that that people that are my age will never forget, and he was almost, you might say, a savior of our country at that time.
Did you find that the money that you were making from your job in the Joint Conservation Corps and your father's job with the WPA, did that lift the family?
It was beautiful. Jim, a dollar went a long ways.
It
didn't
go anywhere.
No. But, as I said, $25 a month for me and $16 a week that my father brought in. Well, we were living it up, so to speak. The strains of my mother's face erased almost overnight.
Yeah.
I could see the improvement.
Right.
It was beautiful. It was beautiful.
All right, that's okay. What kind of work were you doing in those?
In the Civilian Conservation Corps?
Right.
Beautiful work. What every young fellow would love to do. Outdoor work, the construction fire breaks, work to control erosion, such as planting some type of soil control plants near ditches, do you understand what I mean?
Right.
To stop further erosion, cutting down diseased trees,
right.
And wonderful meals, good meals, housing, clothes, plus leave every month to visit your family.
Wasn't virtually all that work done in San Diego County in Cleveland National Forest?
Here in this county, it was. I believe, if I remember, there were two camps primarily. One in Camp Palomar and one in Pine Valley.
So you can still go up there today and see some
you
of your...
Can, in fact, I would love to go up there. I heard that those barracks still exist where I stand.
Barracks?
Well, we lived in... at first, originally, we lived in tents while they were constructing the barracks. Army-type
right.
barracks. Straw mat mattresses. About 40 or 50 of us in one building. And it was great. We'd get on the trucks in the morning and go off on the job and... luncheon would be brought to us in the form of sandwiches, of course, and then a good dinner at night. And we fought fire, too. It was really a very worthwhile project, not only for us, what it did to us, for our morale and for our families, but also the improvement in our forestry service.
All right. So they take you boys up there during the week, and then you come home on the weekends?
Right. Well, no. Actually, we had one weekend a month, and we would hitchhike in and visit our families, and then go back in time to go to work again. Sometimes there would be trucks available, and I enjoyed every minute of it. I spent about 8 months, I believe, or nine there, and to go on with my story. I got word from my uncle, who had relatives in New York City, that jobs were available there. It paid much, much more than I was getting at
the
CCC,
yeah.
Right. And he spoke of fantastic salaries of $12 to $14 a week. So I decided to try it. I was just young enough, and, you know, in my age, I should see a little of the world anyway, and besides, the promise of that extra money was irresistible. So I took a Greyhound bus. I wanted to hitchhike, but my mother wouldn't hear of it. And arrived in New York City, went to that fabulous Sixth Avenue that I was told about, and to my amazement, there they were again, believe it or not. One employment agency after another, with bulletin boards outside, advertising jobs, you name it, elevator operator, dishwasher, porter, mechanics, just a great variety of jobs.
Take your pick.
And for a fee, and a state guaranteed protection, you know, because some of the agencies were unscrupulous and would would sell a non-existent job. But as a whole, most of the jobs were on the level, and that's where I spent the following year. That was 1934 in New York City, and send money home every week, and things were beginning to look up. But,
well, why don't we talk about some of your working experiences? There were no labor unions during this period, but the common labor.
I understand that even San Francisco, even at that time, was what they call a good union town.
But most of the common labor, the work you were doing, say, in New York, was not organized.
No.
Most laborers weren't organized.
No, not at all. Not at all.
What kind of... With jobs so scarce and so many people, 10 men for every one job available, you must have suffered some sort of abuse.
That's what I suffered here in San Diego. I would say 25, 50 men for every job available prior to the CC that we're talking about earlier today. But when I arrived in New York City, anybody that wanted to work and had the price of the job could work. And in fact, some arrangements could be made with the agency whereas they would draw their fees from the first week's salary, you see what I mean? And as unbelievable as it looked to me, it was actually a fact. I worked every day, and I made a good salary under those conditions for a boy my age. I was just turned 21 at the time, and I sent money home, as I mentioned before. And I had a great time for the first time in my life that I could remember in the past 4 or 5 years.
But you didn't witness any abuse suffered by employees at the hands of their employees?
Yes, yes, I know what you're driving at, Jim. Right. Now,
there just had
now this is related to the abuse that I stated earlier, if you can call it abuse, where an employer would... could not resist the offer given by a serviceman, and would let go a civilian and hire him because he was willing to work for less money, you see. But then to come back to the later times when things began to improve, for example, in 1934, San Diego had a miniature World Fair, I think they called it an exposition at the time, and my mother wrote to me about it, and
in New York.
She was right, and she missed me, and of course, and wanted me back, and pointed out to me that jobs were actually opening up. But however, I did come back, and jobs were beginning to open up. But when you did get a job, now this is I would say related to the Depression. I would say a result of the Depression, the abuse was great. I mean, you worked the hours that your employer told you to work. You worked for what he wanted you to work. You didn't dare ask for a raise. You didn't ask for a vacation. You went to work, sick or not. It was an entirely different world as that you know today. When an employer wanted to, the stories were rampant, that when an employer wanted to buy a new car, why, he would just double up the work, lay off a couple of employees, and double the workload on the others that were there. You see what I mean?
Right.
To make up the
and
price that he wanted.
Widespread.
This is the sort of thing. It was widespread, I'm sorry to say. I have worked for employers like that. I have worked at closing time after 12 hard hours, and then suddenly being told that something else to be done. Take off your jacket, get to work. And, well, what could we do? We looked at each other, our mouths would drop open, and take off our jackets, and go right back on the job again.
Right, and this same thing must have happened during the hardest years of the Depression, right? Well, if you made a mistake, like say you were a dishwasher, you dropped the dish, you're fired.
That's it. Well, I mean, well, depending on the individual
employer. On the employer.
But we certainly didn't enjoy anywhere near the freedom that the present-day employees enjoy. We were, well, I hate to use the word, you might say, paid slaves. in a sense.
Yeah. Well, all right, Mr. Franco, you've indicated that once you had returned from New York to San Diego, that the worst effects of the Depression were lessening and things were getting better, and you did have a job. I'd like you to elaborate, if you could, on the working conditions you experienced here in San Diego. We're talking about the years of 34, immediately after you'd returned from New York.
Well, frankly, Jim, after what I had gone through during the worst part of the Depression, it would seem odd, in a sense, to complain about working conditions. In other words, if I had my choice, naturally, of going back 3 years, I would certainly take the present situation, regardless of how bad the conditions, the working conditions were. Definitely, they were far from desirable, whatever word you want to use. People were still, many people were still out of work, and there were still 25 to 30 men waiting for you to drop dead, so to speak, to step in to your job. And even though things were improving, there were still many unemployed. So those of us that were working, as I mentioned before, would rather have the present situation, even though it was far from desirable, than to go back to conditions that existed previously. But however, it seemed to be a situation of greed that existed. That's the only way I can seem to be able to describe it. You were, as I mentioned before, you were constantly taken advantage of. You didn't dare say boo, as I indicated. You came to work whether you were sick or not. There was room for improvement, lots of room for improvement. And this brings to mind about the first attempt of the union to organize here in San Diego. And I was working at a fish market at the time, the only trade that other trade that I knew besides dishwashing. And the union fought desperately to improve our situation, and we were all for it because, you might say in a sense that we had, the saying goes, fall out of the pan into the fire, more or less. In fact, I actually helped to organize the union that was trying to get us together in the fishing industry. And after a rough battle, we finally won. The employer reluctantly signed the contract, and then it was just pure heaven. A vacation was provided. After a year's work, a minimum salary was also stipulated in a contract, and overtime, of course, was to be paid, and also the seventh day, if we were required to work, we would receive extra pay, and that, of course, just made things that much better for us. I won't go into detail about the present the abuses that do exist with unions, but it's a case, it seems to me, of a choice between a more or less well, a choice between two evils, you might say. For example, would you rather not have a union and be at the mercy of an unscrupulous employer, or have a union, good or bad, that protects you from any unfair advantages that you might take?
I see. I understand you've mentioned that in order to realize the better working conditions, you had to go through a rough battle, you said.
Right,
what kind of a rough battle did the fishermen have to go through?
Well, the employer happened to be one of the majority, I'm sorry to say, that resented the union very, very much, and he would have nothing to do with it. And strikes, of course, were threatened, and they had the desirable effect. The union eventually won out, and we found ourselves, as I mentioned before, in a much better working situation.
But what kind of threats did your employer? First of all, what was his name? This was back in San Diego. 1954,
well,
who was it?
I think the gentleman is still living. I hate to mention his name, but it was an owner of one of the fish markets, the leading fish markets that still exists here in San Diego.
I see. So did he actually threaten his employee? Did he actually fire him?
Yes, indeed. You join that union and that's it. You look for another job.
He's still alive right now.
Yeah, he's going to live to a ripe old age in spite of his meanness.
Well, what other kind of experiences did you, what other benefits did you derive from this new agreement once the union had been established? You talked about, earlier about working 12 hours a day and then being asked to work longer.
Right.
Was there any standardization of the working day, for instance?
Right, it was.
Other benefits, if you could say something about it.
There was. All those improvements were made. Now, for example, on Thursdays, we'd have to go to work at 3 o'clock in the morning. Oh, pardon me, that's Friday. Fish day, Friday, you know. 3 o'clock in the morning. In order to put up the orders that the salesman had gathered the day before and have them ready to deliver at 6 o'clock in the morning. That made it a mighty long day, 3 a.m. to
just
about
prior to the new contract.
Prior to the contract, of course. And the union, very justifiably, pointed out to the employer that why couldn't this work be done the night before? Why couldn't the preparations be made, the orders put up and put in the refrigerator? And then the man would come to work at 6 or 6:30 rather than 3 in the morning and ready to distribute the fish to the customers. He wouldn't think of it. He wouldn't listen to it. The fish wouldn't keep, he said. You can't wrap up fish and keep in the refrigerator overnight. So, by golly, I'm glad I thought of this. I conducted, I don't mean to brag, but I secretly conducted a little experiment. Here's what I did. One day when the boss wasn't home, I wasn't at work, I wrapped up an order of fillet of fish. Wrapped it up as we would have done the next morning at 3:30 in the morning. And I hid it in a refrigerator. The next morning we all came to work at 3 o'clock. Of course, I had told all the fellows and the foreman what I had done, and incidentally he was on our side, but he didn't dare say so. And the next morning at about 6 o'clock, we opened up that package that I had put up the night before, and to my amazement, it was in perfect condition. So we relayed this information immediately to the union, who approached the employer and induced him finally to try this experiment, and that did it.
And it worked.
It worked. So no more 3 o'clock in the morning. We finally did away with that, and and had a more normal day, which was still a long day, which eventually was improved even further. We still work from 6 in the morning right. till 6
so
in the evening.
What you're indicating then is that there was more or less a battle of give and take with the employer and the employees during those years, say 1934, 1935.
Yeah, most or less, more give than take.
Was that just confined to the fishing industry here in San Diego, where there were battles being waged between?
No, every industry, Jim, that I can think of, that is organized now, bakery, all types of food delivery and distribution systems, were in the same situation as ours. We worked, as I said before, very long hours to the satisfaction of the employer, regardless of obvious improvements that the union had, in this case, had to prove to my particular employer before they would make these corrections. But slowly they came around. It was, as I said before, a tough battle, but more and more unions got into power, and we all found ourselves in a more desirable and better situation.
So would you say then that the birth of these unions during the latter part of the 30s was a reaction to these abuses we've already spoken of?
Right. Well, of course, that I would say this, Jim. I would say that the unions who saw this abuse that was going on made up their minds they were going to do something about it. And they did. They corrected a bad situation and to our mutual benefit. Of course, the union became strong and established itself as an organization, and you see, of course, to what extent they have done that. And at the same time, the employees, such as myself, had a better deal.
Well, you said that you yourself were in favor of the establishment of your particular union. Did you find that any of your coworkers all for it?
Oh, yes, indeed. Yes, they were scared. They were all scared as I was.
What were some of the fears?
Well, that we'd be thrown out of the job if we indicated in any way that we were for the union. We had to hide this. Our meetings were all in secret. We were scared to attend a meeting, afraid that our employer may be standing across the street to observe who was going. Oh, yes, indeed. We had that fear. Actually, we were scared to death. But I'm glad to say, had the nerve and the initiative to go through this, despite the obvious consequences, if we were discovered, and we won out.
So you'd say that in the days following, say 1934, 1935, here in San Diego, things just took a definite upswing, and days were brighter for the working man.
That's right. The exposition, the start of the fair in the late 1934 and 1935 gave the city a surge. Many tourists whose situation in their cities had improved were visiting, and all businesses picked up. Hiring, of course, increased. More people went to work, and I remember one sign at one of the local department stores. I wish I could think of their name. One day, as the people passed by this particular department store, they saw a sign that the owner had put out, and it said, "Wasn't the Depression awful?"
This was when?
This was in 1935.
Or 1935. I see. Well, that's a good...
Well, it was quite an experience, Jim. I hope something like that never occurs again.
That's one thing I want to ask you. Would you see any beneficial effects for that occurring, say, in my lifetime? Do you think it'd be a good thing for someone like
Oh, God, no, Jim. God, I would not like to see anyone go through that misery again. But we never know from one day to another where we are, especially with the political situations and the economic situations that have this tendency to change almost overnight. But I would say this. I would say this to my own son. In fact, I have had a talk with him about my experiences as I am with you tonight. And I told him if this should ever occur again, the best advice I could give him is to just remember that this happened and
once before
that many people suffered, and not to despair, to stick it out. To stick it out and to know that things will get better, as it did for me.
Well, then that indicates that you never, that's something I want to get into, that indicates to me that you never really had a shaking of your faith in this country then. Did you always believe that things were going to get better? You indicated earlier,
Yes, after going through what I did, after witnessing what I saw, the suffering that I related in the past, and to see that there was a man that could pull us out of it. And I'm talking about the tremendous changes that Franklin Roosevelt originated and that did pull us out of the Depression. I say that if things do occur again, a Depression does occur again, that somewhere a new leader, as Mr. Roosevelt was, will come forth and pull the country out of it again. And I have a deep faith in that, and that we will always remain a great country.
Well, there's just the two more things I'd like to backtrack on now. We're getting near the end here. Earlier, you said that, I wanted to bring this up, earlier you mentioned that when you first realized that things were going to start getting bad, your father had a talk, and he said that he wanted you to finish school. Now, we're talking about high school, aren't we?
Right, that's right.
Was that the case? Was it the case that many students, high school students, were forced to drop out of high school?
Yes, indeed there was, Jim.
There were no laws to stay, requiring them to stay in?
Oh, no, I know. It was a situation of a question of survival then. You see what I mean? Well, it did originate then, your President Snyder part-time school. I believe that's still in operation here in San Diego.
Snyder Continuation.
And some of the lucky ones that did want to finish their education and were lucky enough to find a job, took that course. Worked during the day and continued their education on a part-time basis in the evening. And some travel to other states looking for work.
Right.
Dropped school altogether. I had many personal friends that did just that.
I see. Well, among these personal friends of yours, many of them must have been immigrants, as you yourself were. Now, you've indicated that your faith in this country was never really shaken. What were the feelings of these friends of yours that were in the, so to speak, the same boat as you? What were their reactions? Your relatives, your friends?
Well, I had several conversations with some of my friends who were in the same situation as I was. And as I said before, some of them indicated that they were going to Oklahoma to work on a farm, and others were going to the big city, for example, as I went later to New York, and there was more opportunity there. Whether they found this opportunity, what happened to them, I can't say, but they saw no point. They did not have the incentive to continue their education. What the compelling force was for them at that time was to find something somewhere to make a living. That was the driving force, you see, at the time. And I might add, unfortunately, in some cases that I knew, some friends that I knew personally, turned into crime, you see, and ruined their lives in that respect, of course.
But no one ever spoke of going back to where they came from, did they?
You mean
going back to Europe, the old country?
Oh, no, no, I don't remember in conversation that I overheard during visits to my house by friends of my father. I don't remember anyone ever mentioning such a thing. They did compare the situation that they were going through then, and some of them said it was just as bad, and some of them would say, oh, this is worse than the old country was, and conversations of that nature. But even if they had the means, I don't believe that at least I never heard of anyone expressing a desire to leave the country and go back, because as I mentioned earlier in our conversation, I think that they had this. In fact, that's why they left their homes in the first place, because they wanted to come to this country. And then, of course, when they were disappointed and crushed, is a better word, as the result of the depression, why I heard of no one who wished to go to return to their homeland.
They believed in the country and its potential then.
Well, to be perfectly honest, it was either that they believed that we would pull out of this, or else they just didn't have the necessary funds to make this change. It takes money to go back all the way to Europe, and then what would they go to? You see what I mean? They're
right.
Probably into a worse situation than, or just as bad as the one that existed here.
So they just, most of the people around you decided they'd just wait out this.
Wait it out.
Wait out the depression.
And not knowing, of course, just how long it would last, but just hoping for the best. From month to month, from year to year.
Okay, well, I think that's a good note to close this interview on. I think I'd like to thank you for your time.
Well, it was a pleasure, Jim.
For your thoughts.
Thank you very much. Very glad to do it.